and merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Bank, a friendly bank in a friendly town. Now, here are your hosts, Ed Corcoran and Dick Bertel.
Good evening. And with me once again is radio historian collector Ed Corcoran. Ed, our guest is a delightful, beautiful personality.
Yes, it certainly is true, Dick. And another first, the first actress we've ever had who won the Academy Award. A very great achievement, and we're very, very happy to have her with us tonight, that's for sure.
We're talking, of course, about Joan Fontaine, who is appearing at the Chateau de Ville Dinner Theater in Cactus Flower from now until June 1st. Joan, it's a pleasure to have you here on the Golden Age of Radio.
Well, it's a thrill for me.
I wish we could show your movies, but we can't do that on radio. But it is interesting to note that many actors and actresses during the time that radio was prominent, during the time of the Lux Radio Theater and so
30s
on.
30s and 40s, really.
30s and 40s, yeah. Mm. They were very active, and you were, too. You did quite a bit on radio, didn't you?
Oh, yes, we had United States Steel Hour, we had the Lux and so on, Hollywood Hotel. Mm-hmm. There were many.
And you indicated that they paid pretty well.
Indeed, they paid beautifully.
That's always a nice thing, a nice aspect to know about radio. Were you ever in any way in, let's say, in a difficult situation because of radio, because you didn't have, let's say, a camera to work with, you didn't have the visual element to work with?
That didn't bother me at all, but it reminds me of a funny story. I was coming back east to do a United States Steel program, and I had been invited to the White House. And Mrs. Roosevelt was there, and she was a rather strict hostess. And we had oysters for the first course, so I had never liked oysters. I ate one and finished the dinner and got absolutely giddy. I knew I was going to be terribly sick. Got on the train, was violently ill, taken off, put to bed in my hotel, and I had domain, or allergy, probably, mm-hmm. and missed the show. It was the most expensive oyster I've ever had in my life.
They weren't in season either. That was the worst part of it.
What was the show you missed?
I forgot.
Oh, but they had to get a replacement, obviously.
I had my own show, and it wasn't very pleasant. Oh, yes, indeed.
Joan, let's talk about your movie career, because that's, I'm sure, the aspect that most people want to hear about. I first remember seeing you in Rebecca. That was a beautiful film. And
Well, Ed remembers me in something else, I'm afraid, don't you?
Yes, prior to that, she made a film called Damsel in Distress, which had a very significant actor in there. And why don't you tell us about that, Joan?
Yeah.
I'm sure you must remember that.
Fred Astaire, but what had happened was that he had split up with Ginger Rogers, and Ginger was undoubtedly his best partner. They both had figures like umbrellas, and they mm-hmm. just were gorgeous. It was the Prince and Cinderella. There were many reasons why the chemistry was superb. And very often in teams like that, that are great, Nelson Eddy, Jeanette McDonald, there's something right about the chemistry which they don't think about today in casting. But anyway, I unfortunately had to walk in there in a Woodhouse movie, Plummy Woodhouse did it, and be his dancing leading lady. And I had only had formal ballet, I can tell you, and that was agony. Not only couldn't I really dance very well, but I had enormous blisters. I was dancing in high heels on summer day, and I didn't even tell them. I was too nervous. So I had these third-degree blisters, if there are such things, and every bit was painful. But I think it was painful for the audience more than for me afterwards.
Have you seen the film at all recently?
I had to go to a Gershwin thing, and they had a little bit of it on. I've seen only two or three films of mine in my life. Mm-hmm. And the agony for not only me, but other actors say the same thing, that they can't sit through their own pictures.
Well, I was just going to say, if you've only seen two or three of your own pictures, that means you don't go to opening nights then. Hmm?
I go. I had to. You were ordered to, wearing the orchid corsage and the white fox fur in those days. But I would sneak out the moment the lights went out. I would take the nearest exit.
Well, you decided to abandon a dancing career then at that film. You never
I decided to abandon me, quite frankly.
Well, I was quite he was quite a perfectionist, wasn't he, as far
as... Oh, he's a modest person to work with, too, and helpful and dear. Oh, yes, he couldn't have been nicer.
Joan, was Olivia de Havilland, your sister, did she decide to make acting her career before you did? And were you influenced
well,
by her at all?
Well, she, of course, is older than I am, like 45 years, 50 years older than I am. So, naturally,
She's waiting outside.
She's really my aunt.
We're going to spring her on you a little later. But was that one of the
influences? No, I think it was my mother who had been to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, didn't like our voices, so made us practice Shakespeare and everything as small children. Incidentally, the language I came speaking to the United States when I was 2 1/2 was Japanese.
Really?
Yes. And I hear with an atrocious English accent at that. But, of course, English parents...
Well, you were born in Tokyo.
Yeah. And we had English accents, and then they kind of were supplanted by local California ones, which Mother did not approve of. We weren't very far away from Mr. Steinbeck and all that, so she insisted that we learn diction, and then we had the usual ballet and all the equipment that ladies were supposed to have in those days. They weren't supposed to go to college. I sound as though it was a century ago, but English ladies didn't. And so we had all those niceties, like cooking and sewing and gardening and typing. We had every kind of lesson anybody ever could. We were surrounded by tutors.
Armed with all of these lessons, how did you make it into the films?
Painful.
What was your...
With great
I
difficulty.
Knew you were going to do that to me.
Oh, it's not no fun. I had come back from school in Japan, and some friends, I'd done all the school plays and things like that, said they knew Mae Robson, and would I like to meet her, because she's looking for an English ingenue for a kind lady. I did meet her, and she said, "You're it." I got tagged right away and came on, not in a bit role, but in an ingenue role. And I was talking to students at the Boston University where I was lecturing last week, and they don't believe that you can get right into it. I played only 2-bit parts in my life, thank goodness.
Yes, it was different
honest.
At that point. Mm-hmm. You usually started out as a star. If you didn't, you were always a bit player, I guess.
But not only that, you're too old.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I find today that is not so. In my day, where the young girl dream, American beauty, had to be early 20s.
Right.
Now, today, which is kind of marvelous because they're much better actors, Burstyn and all the other people are older women, comparatively speaking, that are coming into stardom.
Mm-hmm. Which would indicate, in one sense at least, a maturity on the part of audiences to accept this type of role. In other words...
Maybe the roles are that way. Maybe they're not writing for the young, beautiful dame, the 20-year-old... Look at Grace Kelly. She was a has-been, practically, by the time she married.
I told you earlier that we saw a funny lady with, of course,
Streisand,
the delightful Barbara Streisand. And the director of photography was James Wong Hong.
Oh, marvelous guy.
And you can see his work, you know, from beginning to end in that film. I mean, just absolutely the most technically perfect film you'd ever want to see. Did you ever have an opportunity to work with him?
Yes, I worked with him, and I can't remember the picture. I was afraid you were going to ask me that. But after all, I've had 45 films, and I've worked with some of the best cameramen ever.
Yeah.
And some fabulous directors like Hitchcock and Kazan, Goulding, Cukor, probably the best director of them all for me. George Stevens, I've been very lucky. Fritz Lang, Max Opels.
Well, with Hitchcock, you did the very first American film that he ever made.
Is that true? Was it really his first,
that
Rebecca?
That was his first American film, Rebecca, that's right. So how about that? You didn't know that, huh?
No, I'm glad you're wrong. Tell me more.
Would you like us to turn on the projector and show you the film?
No, thank you.
Well, I did notice that you were always cast as an English lady, even though you never did live in England, did you, during your formative years?
No,
America or Japan,
that's
yet
right.
All your films, you were English.
Well, that's my mother's diction lessons.
Everybody
working
think you're
there.
English?
Yeah.
I didn't realize you were an American until some time later.
Well, I became an American citizen in 1941.
No, but as far as your
background,
your casting and so forth, every film you made, you were in England someplace, it seemed like.
Yes.
I was just going to say, was that the picture, Rebecca, that really...
started me. I was a has-been before that.
Were you really?
Yeah, I really was. I had made about 16 films. I was called the Queen of the Bees, and I really had,
you're serious?
Had my career.
You're no? serious?
Mm-mm.
I thought Lynn Barry had that title.
I was 21 years old, and they said, forget it. You're not going to get anywhere. And I did The Women, and Q Corp told David Selznick, well, actually, I met David Selznick at a dinner party, and he said, do you want a test, Rebecca? So I said, yes, indeed, I did. Then Hitchcock made a test of me after a lot of other people tested me as well. Everybody tested for that. Loretta Young, I can't tell you, Susan Hayward. And I was lucky enough to get the part, which was a pretty good second career.
Yeah, I would think so. I think it's about time that we heard Joan Fontaine at work.
Yes, well, you did make another film not too long after Rebecca called Frenchman's Creek, right? There was a costume drama, and
Didn't like that one.
It wasn't real Boffo.
I loved Afton Jure's work, and had that been made in black and white, it was a natural for black and white. And I went on suspicion rather than take it, and I got so hounded. This is that contract system that they had at the time,
mm-hmm.
and they had terrible things about you in the press. This was all a deliberate campaign to weaken you and break you down. It really was the Chinese torture thing.
Yeah,
and then you gave in. You had to capitulate. You were also not being paid.
Yeah, that,
and by this time they'd always got you to, you know, have the big house and the Rolls Royce and that kind of thing going, so that they could do this to you. So when finally I kicked up enough fuss, I realized that I just was doomed, and I had to get into this. And this was the beginning of a bad point in my career, because the producers didn't mind. They didn't mind if they killed you off. They wanted your name up there, the most lavish production they could get, which they got. Whether it was true to the author, to the play, or to the actors, didn't make one bit of difference.
Well, I'm confused, Joan, as to what difference it made whether it was in color or black and white.
Oh, because there's a natural. I mean, if Rebecca had been in color, it would have been awful. There are certain films. Well, take Paper Moon. Yes,
yeah.
If these had been in color, they wouldn't have been anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You need mood.
Right. Yeah,
and black
right.
and white and gray is lovely for mood.
All right, well then, let's instruct our audience to visualize this drama in black and white,
that's
all right?
Instead of color. So here is Frenchman's Creek with Joan Fontaine.
The Radio Theater. Starring Joan Fontaine and David Niven in Frenchman's Creek. Ladies and gentlemen, your producer, Mr. William Keeley.
Greeting from Hollywood, ladies and gentlemen. Glancing through the almanac, I find that February 10th calls for a carnival in honor of the pirate Gasparillo, one of our better-known buccaneers, who plundered the shores of the Atlantic in a pursuit that has always fired our imagination and given us many of our most exciting legends. Tonight, in that tradition, we present a colorful saga of piracy and romance in Paramount Pictures' thrilling drama, Frenchman's Creek. And our stars are Joan Fontaine in her original screen role and that popular Scottish actor, David Niven. Our story takes us back to 17th century England, a period as colorful as the rich and dazzling costumes of its men and women. It's time for our play, and here's Act One of Frenchman's Creek, starring Joan Fontaine as Lady Donna and David Niven as the Frenchman. London, 1668. Lord Harrison Cullen has just come home after a night at the gaming tables. Mounting the broad staircase, he stops suddenly. For facing him is his wife, dressed for traveling.
Donna, what the devil is this?
I'm leaving London, Harry, with the children.
Really, my dear, this is ridiculous.
Is it?
When you left the gaming tables tonight and rushed home, why, everybody
you
thought...
You promised me Lord Rockingham would not be there.
Oh, Donna, Rockingham's my closest friend.
I will not endure his familiarity any longer.
Fiddle-dee-dee. Rock doesn't mean a thing. Good heavens, Donna, he's not serious.
He's very serious as far as I'm concerned, and I will not put up with it any longer.
So you're leaving. And where do you think you'll go?
I'm going to Navarin.
Navarin? Well, we haven't been there for years. It's damp, moldy, full of ghosts.
Yes, it is full of ghosts, Harry. Ghosts of a happiness that's lost. I'm going to try to get it back. I've done with this stupid life we lead here and the company you choose to keep.
If you think I'm going to come chasing down to Cornwall after you, you're wrong.
Should you wish to kiss the children goodbye, you'll find them waiting with their nurse in the coach.
Turn up. Welcome to Navarin House, m'lady.
Thank you. When you met me at the gates, you told me your name is William. But just who are you?
Why, I am your steward, m'lady.
What happened to Barclay?
He was an old man, m'lady. It's 2 years since he's gone to his reward.
Well, I can't say I'm overly happy with your stewardship, William. This place smells like a tomb. There's dust everywhere.
I was not aware of your coming, madam. I've been alone here for many months.
Well, then hire servants immediately. You will see that everything takes place as though the mistress of Navarin House has never been away. My children, their nurse, and I plan to remain indefinitely.
It will be a pleasure, m'lady.
Where are the children?
In the garden with their nurse, madam, while you've been going through the house.
William, I noticed two strange things in my rooms upstairs.
Strange?
Yes. One is a portrait on the wall of a young girl.
M'lady, that is your own portrait.
Yes. I think that I once looked like that.
M'lady, you still do.
I said two strange things. This is the other. This jar of tobacco. What was it doing in my room?
A jar of tobacco?
It's yours, isn't it?
I don't use tobacco, m'lady.
But if you've been here alone, and... Well, never mind. We'll forget about it. William, as we drew closer to Navarin on our journey, I heard strange talk of this place. Talk of ghosts.
Ghosts? Few days here, m'lady, and you'll learn it's gossip for sure. No ghosts.
But there is a strange feeling about it. And if...
Did you say something, m'lady?
No, William. Nothing. Come in, William.
Good morning, m'lady. Did you rest well?
Very well.
No ghosts?
Well, if there were, they were most considerately quiet. William, the children and I have decided to have a picnic today.
I felt confident you would, m'lady. I've prepared a suitable luncheon basket.
Oh, thank you. We'll be in the wood near the chapel.
Yes, m'lady. Oh, there's a visitor waiting downstairs.
Visitor?
Yes, your neighbor, m'lady, Lord Godolphin. Will you see him?
I'm afraid I'll have to. Tell the children I won't be long.
Well, I came over as soon as I heard you were at Navarin. Pay my respects.
Oh, I'm enchanted to see you, Lord Godolphin.
Harry's not with you.
No, I'm here alone with the children.
Pity. Great pity. We need Harry's help. You've heard of our troubles here, of course.
Well, I've heard nothing.
Oh, really? Too remote down here, I suppose. Madam, we've been vexed by parrots at our wits' end. Why, only a week ago, Lord Eustace's home was sacked.
How distressing.
Distressing? It's an outrage. We complain to London, and what do we get? A few soldiers. No good at all. The squires must band together and deal with this thing themselves.
Well, if there's anything I can do to help...
Nothing, dear lady. Except ask Harry to come down and help us fight this Frenchman.
Frenchman?
Yes. The French have made a habit of coming over to Cornwall ever since
our own Cornish pirates have gone over
to
France.
I don't realize how serious this matter is. We're being robbed right and left. Our womenfolk in terror of their lives.
Why?
Why? Well, really, madam, I... I think I must be getting home.
I'm sorry, my lord. Forgive me. I shall write to Harry at once.
Thank you, dear lady. Good day.
William.
My lady.
I came to Navarin to be alone, William.
I understand. No more visitors. You shall make good your escape.
Escape? You have an uncanny intuition, William. Where did you get it?
My late master. Much of my philosophy is borrowed from him.
Why did you leave him?
His life is such at the moment that my services would be of little use to him. He travels.
Then he's a fugitive, too. People who travel usually are.
His life, if I may say so, is one continual escape. I think you and my master would have much in common, Lady St. Colum. Shall I call the children now?
Please, and Miss Prynne. The nurse will picnic with us.
Look at them, madam. Both little ones fast asleep.
They've played so hard, Prynne. Poor little things. The first real picnic they've ever known.
Be time to go home soon. Shall I wake them?
No, let them sleep. I think I'll go for a walk, Prynne. On our way here, I thought I saw a creek. I never knew there was a creek on our estate. I should like to see it.
Oh, be careful, madam, please.
Oh, don't worry, Prynne. I won't be long.
It is. It is a creek.
Yes, madame.
Who are you?
I cannot answer that, madame.
Take your hands off me. Let me go.
Be quiet.
Help!
Scream now all you wish to, madame. If you ask me, all women should be gagged. Come now, the captain does not like to be kept waiting.
Frenchman's Creek, or at least a portion thereof, with our guest here on the Golden Age of Radio, lovely Joan Fontaine, and we'll get back to our guest right after this message.
Family expanding? Need more living space? If the answer to these questions is yes, then now, during the spring of the year, is the ideal time to visit Cromwell Savings Bank and discuss a home improvement loan. Perhaps you plan to finish an uncompleted room, add another bathroom or a dormer, or get going on that long overdue addition to your present home. In any case, the folks at Cromwell Savings Bank will be most happy to discuss your home expansion plans with you and possibly help make your dreams become a reality. Stop in any time at Cromwell Savings Bank, conveniently located at the corner of Main and West Streets in Cromwell. Or if you prefer, call for an appointment. Cromwell Savings is open Monday through Wednesday from 9 to 3, Thursdays from 9 to 5, Fridays from 9 to 7:30, and now Saturdays from 9 to 12 noon. Let them show you how a Cromwell home improvement loan may take the cramp out of your family's lifestyle. Cromwell Savings Bank, a member of FDIC, is an equal housing lender.
Joan Fontaine is appearing, as perhaps most of you know by this time, at the Chateau de Ville Dinner Theater.
In East Windsor.
In East Windsor.
Another smasheroo.
That's right. And we're...
In Cactus Farm.
Cactus Farm. Delightful show.
Starring Russell Knight.
Yep, you got it.
We're just getting these things in subliminally here so that...
good dinner.
But at any rate, we're talking not about Cactus Flower, but about your career in movies and your career on radio. It wasn't a career as such. It really... was an enhancement of...
My banker would say it was a career.
Well, we were indicating earlier that they did pay well. They were looking for 4 stars in many of these shows, weren't they?
Well, what they were actually was an abridged version of the entire movie. Mm-hmm. And if you lived in the country, where this is before drive-in theaters, I suppose, you couldn't get to the movie house. So you would listen to it, and you could discuss this rather intelligently with people who had seen the film. You would have the hour, or an hour and a half, maybe. I think it was an hour, wasn't it, Ed?
Yeah, it's a full hour.
Full hour.
Mm-hmm. Were the film producers at all concerned about, let's say, a dramatization of Rebecca on radio before it had filled out its run in the movie theaters?
I don't think they would have allowed
that. No, usually it was held back then.
Not
it was a couple of years.
Sometimes
though.
It was current with the showing in the movie houses for some reason. I guess they publicized it much more.
Well, it was never a competition then as such, I would
assume.
No,
it's hard. It really, they coexisted. It really is strange when you bring it up. Because,
might have been a teaser.
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. that's it. You can't do it in an hour, what you can do in a film. No two ways about it.
You are an Academy Award winner, Joan Fontaine, and you received that award for a movie called...
Suspicion!
Was it Cary Grant? Was it
was indeed. And another nomination for The Constant Nymph, which I adore. That was a beautiful film with Charles Boyer.
Do you ever... I've asked you this earlier, but don't you turn on the TV set at night?
Once did. And with some obscure film I'd made, and I said, this girl's rather familiar. Who could she be? And I, oh, my goodness, it's me. Off went the set, onto another channel.
Why do actors or actresses feel that way?
I think opera singers do, too. They can't bear their own voices. They're afraid they'll make mistakes. They're sharp or flat. They know they haven't. But there is some kind of instinctive thing that it's just frightening. I don't know. Do you like looking in the mirror too much? I don't.
No.
I never do.
No. But, the point is that you have an opportunity, I would think. I'm just exploring the situation to analyze your work, or is it impossible to really be that self-critical?
You see the rushes every single day.
Oh.
You've seen 30 takes every single day. That's where you learn. And you say, I turn my head too much, my voice is breaking on that note, and... Oh, yes, you're very strict with yourself on those things.
When you're doing 14 or 30 takes of a scene, do you tend to hold back
no.
at first?
No, because you hope that the silly director is going to say print with the first day. And he usually doesn't know the difference between the first and the 30th, by the way.
That's very true. Very, very little difference, if any, exists.
It's just captain of the ship.
How much control does the cameraman have over photographing a star? Is he in your hands?
No, but people like Loretta Young, for instance, Cary Grant, too, they know their faces so well that they can tell a cameraman pretty much where to put the lights. Mm-hmm. I didn't ever arrive at that, but I do know that he must keep the camera above my eyes, for instance, or since I have wide cheekbones, I get flattened out to lengthen the face, you know, your camera angles. A lot of people have, little peculiarities with maybe the nose isn't quite right. And there was one example of an actress who was going down, and there was a train station, and she had to get on the train, and she said to the director, the set's fine, cost $5 million or something, but it's all wrong for my angle, you have to change it. And they had to stop the picture and rebuild the set the other side.
Oh, my.
Yep.
Does that go on today?
I shouldn't think so.
I don't think so.
That's another reason I don't want to make films today, is because you have no control of making yourself look as decent as you can. They can shoot you from any angle, and especially when cameramen, and they will invariably do it, and I don't know why, they will shoot anybody from below. Well, even a baby looks awful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, great big wallowy chins from below and up the nostrils, and that's not a good angle. But I remember one cameraman was taking my picture, and I said, please, would you mind putting the camera high, and he said, well, Miss Fontaine, look, I've been doing this for 20 years. And I said, well, I've been doing it for 35, so put that camera up there.
They didn't have much argument then.
He laughed. He was fun.
Well, yeah, television, it's much harder because the action, especially in these live tape shows, you really can't do anything with the lighting. You just have to just wing it all the way through.
As it is, sure.
But with movies, every scene can be just tailor-made to your
and
own.
And women are beautified and made to look glorious. I mean, just think of, I think the most beautiful woman in the world was Greta Garbo. But even a woman with that face, the camera angles are superb, and the lighting there, you don't see the shadow of her nose across her face or any of those things that you see today.
Well, they said in Frenchman's Creek that you were never lovelier than in that film. That was the best photograph ever.
Well, it's a marvelous cameraman, no doubt. But,
that's Ed's favorite film.
Obviously,
it's not yours.
I got the Harvard Lampoon Award for the Worst Actress of the Year for that one.
Well, then maybe your instincts are right.
I really did. Oh, it was awful.
Well, that's a shame. I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, I think the film that everybody remembers, it's played all the time, is Gunga Din, and you were the only lead in that, only female lead.
You're pretty safe that way, aren't you?
Was that just shot on a back lot, that whole
it
film?
It was not. It was shot up near Needles, California, in the deserts, and I remember the heat and everything else. It was Victor McLaglen and Doug Fairbanks and Cary Grant were... didn't need artificial perspiration for that one.
No, I'm sure.
Real, huh?
Sam Jaffe.
Did you ever find yourself in a harrowing experience as far as making a film is concerned? Actors have lost their lives in the production of motion pictures, and I'm just wondering if you were ever in any sort of difficulty.
I ended up in the hospital. I was doing some small B picture with a chap called Herman Bricks. I don't remember where this comes from now, and he had been the national shot putter. So he was showing off, and I was just crossing from one set to another. Then I heard shouts, and wham, sounded like an egg was broken on a cement floor. It was me, my head.
Goodness.
And they got me to a hospital, and I remember one of the gaffers was holding me up, and I was streaming blood all over him. And by the time I got to the hospital, I couldn't stand it. He knelt in the elevator, and I sat on his lap, and he said, oh, if I could only take it for you, if I only could take it for you. And they got me in the operating room, no anesthetic, stitched out my scalp. And I remember the shaving of the hair and everything was too awful. And I'll have you know, that night, that rock was sent me autographed by Mr. Bricks. Wasn't that sweet of him?
Did you send it back?
I could have thrown it back.
Who is your favorite leading man? If that's
at the moment, you.
Oh, thank you, Joan.
Always the one at the moment.
Wait till Russell Knipe hears about this. But at any rate, was there any one particular...
Charles Boyer, actor? Without a doubt. I mean, head and shoulders over every... First of all, he was a fine stage actor. He was a gentleman. That's an awfully old-fashioned word, isn't it? But he was. And he cared about the quality of the film and the other actor. He didn't care at all about himself. He didn't have to because he was so modest. nothing small or mean or petty about him in any way, or bigoted or pig-headed. He just wanted, if it was a little easier for you, for him to do it one way, he'd say, what would you like me to do? You know, would it help you if... Oh, marvelous lesson.
Those are the kinds of people you really enjoy and really respect, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. Now, I've had some terrible prima donnas, you know, who accuse you of getting in your lights and... Oh, I can't... male actors, hello? Any male actors listening?
We have a surprise for you, incidentally. Oh, at least Ed has a surprise.
You've got my sister coming in, now you've got a couple of male actors coming in. Oh, grand. I'm so glad I came. But I always think that they are less... I always say an actor is less of a man and an actress is more of a woman, because she has to do it. She's got to run the house and have the children and be the banker and act as well. She has a pretty big job there.
Well, I hope I don't bend your sense of humor on this one, but this is the Gulf Theater, and the show is Waterloo Bridge. You remember doing that at all?
Yes, I do. Who was with me?
Well, Brian O'Hearn, does that name ring familiar with
my first husband? It's his birthday today.
Really?
I thought you might enjoy this for nostalgia's sake. You and Brian O'Hearn doing Waterloo Bridge.
Good evening, everyone. Your neighborhood good Gulf dealer and the Gulf Oil Company welcome you to the Gulf Screen Guild Theater. Tonight, we're privileged to present one of the most beautiful plays and motion pictures of all time, Waterloo Bridge, starring Joan Fontaine and Brian Ahern. It's a dramatic love story against a background of thrilling music by Oscar Bradley's Gulf Orchestra, with Frank Tours conducting. That burst of applause, ladies and gentlemen, is for Brian Ahern and Joan Fontaine, who are just entering our Gulf Theater stage. They step to the microphone, the house lights dim, and we present Robert E. Sherwood's play, Waterloo Bridge, with Joan Fontaine as Myra Lester and Brian Ahern as Captain Roy Cronin. There's the downbeat for the orchestra, and the play begins. London, 1939. The lights of Waterloo Bridge are hung against a yellow curtain of fog. A chauffeur-driven car pulls out of a slow-moving stream of traffic and noses to the curb. Its passenger is a handsome man in a colonel's uniform, gray-haired, erect, and reserved. The chauffeur turns and speaks.
Is this all right, Colonel Cronin?
Yes, is it? Polaroid, Thomas. I'll get out here.
Yes, sir. You've a little over an hour before your train leaves, sir.
An hour, eh? Well, how patterns repeat themselves. Yes. I remember another time I was here on Waterloo Bridge. And I was bound for France then, too.
That was in 1916, wasn't it, sir?
17. 17 in June. Yes. I stood here at the rail. I was a young captain then. With leave almost over, having a last look at London.
Fine sight from the bridge on a clear night, sir.
Yes, and it was a clear night 22 years ago. 22 years ago. All that time. And yet it's as clear as day.
Keep moving, please. Keep moving.
Oh, sorry, officer. Just stopped for a last look at London.
Well, been on leave, sir.
Yes, going back tomorrow.
Well, good luck, sir. Keep moving up ahead there, please. Keep moving.
Listen, the siren, Zeppelin, they're coming over.
There it is again.
It's a
raid.
Oh, I don't believe it can be.
Yes?
Is that an air raid,
Wally?
I'm afraid it is.
Oh, dear, what should we do?
Where can we go?
To the underground stations, on your right.
Hurry,
Kitty, now, keep ahead. Don't run now. Walk.
Oh, dear, my bag.
Come on, come on.
It's
they're coming
bag.
Over.
My lucky charm.
Little fool, are you tired of life?
I've got to have my charm. I've had it for years. It brings me luck. All right, I'm ready.
All right, come along, come along. I say, can't you walk any faster?
Would it be too unmilitary if we were to run?
No. On the contrary, I think it'd be a great idea. You can stop being frightened now. It's a wonderful institution, the Underground.
Thank you for helping me.
Oh, no, not at all. I don't see any of your friends.
Perhaps they took another entrance.
A cigarette?
No, thanks.
Oh, no, of course not. I suppose you're still at school, aren't you?
School, I?
What, am I being funny?
Look over there. See that poster? That's my school.
Madame Olga Kirova.
Kirova. Oh. And a Russian petite ballet. We're at the Tivoli Theater.
Oh, look here. You don't mean to say you're a dancer?
Certainly. Our act goes on at 10.
What do you usually do after the show?
Oh, go home, go to bed, read myself to sleep.
Haven't you ever heard that reading in bed's bad for the eyes? Oh, look. Now, how about having supper with me at the Candlelight Club?
Oh, I couldn't. Madame Kirova doesn't allow us to have social engagements.
Oh, Pierre.
I'll pick you up at the stage door.
Oh, no, it's quite impossible.
I'll be there at 11.
Oh, no, I tell you, it's quite impossible. But if you are there, please... Please don't let Madame Kirova see you.
Waterloo Bridge. I hope the title doesn't have any significance there.
That
for
was
any
remade,
of
I believe.
Not Watergate Bridge, no.
That was a very, very touching story. It actually turned out that he was supposed to have been killed in the war, and yeah. Then he came back, and she had gone to the streets, and then they reunited. It was quite a love story.
We'll get back to our guest, Joan Fontaine, right after this.
Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Perhaps 1975 is the year you've decided to improve your home's exterior appearance. New plantings for the front yard, a new driveway, or that backyard patio, a swimming pool you've always desired. Well, these two can be yours with a home improvement loan from the folks at Cromwell Savings Bank. Springtime is action time, so visit them soon. They're open Monday through Wednesday, 9 to 3, Thursday, 9 to 5, Fridays, 9 to 7:30, Saturdays, 9 to 12 noon.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member of FDIC, an equal housing lender, is located at Main and West Streets, Cromwell.
Our guest is Joan Fontaine here on the Golden Age of Radio. Joan, incidentally, is appearing at the Chateau de Ville Dinner Theater in East Windsor in...
Cactus Flower
with Russell Knight.
Right.
And it's a good show. It's a delightful show. If you haven't had the opportunity to see them in this particular production of it, by all means, get up there and see it.
And they can take the children and their grandmothers, too.
Which is... you can't say that about many shows these days, you know.
Indeed, you can't take them to any movies that I know of.
I'd like to talk to you a little bit about Jane Eyre. Was there anything special about the filming of the movie? I mean, I recall
Orson. Orson's a pretty big man in every way.
Yeah.
I remember especially that because we had a very nice director called Robert Stevenson, and we were called for, I think, 2 o'clock on the set, and we all sat around in our little director's chairs with our names on them. No Orson. At about 4:45, in comes this huge man with a lot of flunkies beside him, and goes to a music stand, which we hadn't noticed, by the way, on the set, opens the script, and he said, "All right, let's start at page 7. And the director said, yes, Mr. Wells. And we all, by this time, said, "Yes, Mr. Wells." Nobody fought him back. And he ran the works from then on. It was a great theatrical tour de force to do that.
Sure, sure.
But he had worn us down.
Did you see him saluted on television a couple of months back?
I was in my own theater, so I couldn't.
Yeah. He weighs 350 pounds now.
You don't fool around with him even today, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I imagine any directors who turn actors, like Otto Preminger and so forth, would be very hard to control because they have their own way of doing things. But this is a case where he really won out. Huh?
Indeed he did. Oh, yes.
What was Hitchcock like as a director?
He had an interesting theory of divide and conquer, which was to get all the actors against each other. I remember the third or fourth day he came to me and he said, "Joan, Laurence Olivier really wants Vivian Leigh to do this part, but I'm for you, kid." And, you know, then you'd never speak to Laurence Olivier again, and he did this constantly with everybody.
Well, what was the purpose of that? So that he could maintain
divide control? And conquer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. In addition to Hitchcock, is there any particular director that...
George Cukor. Head really? And shoulders above everybody as far as telling me what the essence of acting is. And I remember I'd been to Max Reinhardt School. I'd been to every place. I had to unlearn most of those. And George, this day, we'd gone through Stanislavski and, oh, you know, the various voices and things you're supposed to do. And I said, what gesture would you, what? And he said, oh, Joan, stop. He said, think and feel. And the rest will take care of itself. And for screen acting, that's all you really have to do. When you say somebody is a bad actor, they're not thinking. You don't see anything going on in their minds.
Mm-hmm.
The camera picks that up particularly. And I think the greatest example was Spencer Tracy, who could just do absolutely nothing, and you knew exactly what he was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Very little effort. Tremendous concentration. The same applies for the stage, though. The good actor is a thinking actor. I don't mean that he's not thinking about his part, but he must be thinking as the character thinks. He must have progression in his thinking. Otherwise, the next line is not spontaneous.
Do you enjoy the stage
more than
preference than
only because I don't like directors. I'm a woman's liver, as you can tell. I'm a very independent lady. And just because a man is up there telling me what to do, he'll tell me when he won't tell a man. And he'll say, well, now really, Miss Fontaine, or Joan, now really. And do it again. And he wouldn't dream of doing that. I had a director once, only a few years ago, in Chicago, get up, take my handbag, and show me how to make an exit. And you know exactly what I mean, too.
Yeah, yeah,
don't
I think
you?
I do.
Instead of laughing, which I should have, I was mortified. But I should have just screamed with laughter.
Yeah.
But had I done that, he would have had some other kind of revenge. So, going back to your question, I like being on the stage because the moment the director is gone, I don't have a boss.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly going to act within the bounds of of having been directed. I'm not going to do anything wild. But I don't have somebody telling me what to do.
That's
you
very
see why I don't stay married long.
All you have is a camera crew and a few hangers-on, you might say. And how do you know, or how do you contrast the whether you're getting your part across?
With a marvelous director, you can feel each other.
Even
well, Max Opels, for instance. He would come over, he only spoke German, really, and he would start in German, and I would say, yes, I know, and he said, I don't understand it, but you do know what I want. If it's really right, there's an enormous creative force between you and your director, when they're not the other kind that are domineering.
Well,
and that's killing.
It's a director's medium, isn't it? The films, for the most part.
And the cameraman, of course. But I always think that 90% of any theatrical success, including movies, is the writer, the script. And you can't make
a good script.
You cannot make a good film without a good script.
That's right. We have a good script here from the Academy Award Theater.
Yes, this is a show called The Portrait of Jenny, and you play a rather young girl, I guess around 16, and you did it very well.
Thanks. I was 16 once. I have a good memory.
House of Squibb presents Academy Award. Tonight, Joan Fontaine in Portrait of Jenny with John Lund. Every week, Squibb brings you Hollywood's finest. The great picture plays, the great actors and actresses, techniques and skills chosen from the honor roll of those who have won or been nominated for the famous Golden Oscar of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Squibb is a name you can trust. Tonight, Squibb brings to Academy Award Robert Nathan's famous story, Portrait of Jenny. As our star, you will hear lovely Joan Fontaine, who has three times been nominated as Best Actress of the Year and in 1941 won the Academy Award. Appearing with Miss Fontaine is the talented young actor John Lund. And now, Academy Award. There is such
such a thing as hunger for more than food. And that was the hunger I fed on. Yes, there's another kind of suffering for the artist, which is worse than anything a winter or poverty can do. It's more like a winter of the mind, in which the life of his genius, the living sap of his work, seems frozen and motionless, caught perhaps forever in a season of death. And who knows if spring will ever come again to set it free. One evening in the winter of 1938, I was walking home through Central Park. That night I was at the bottom, without money or friends, cold and hungry and tired, without hope. I crossed the drive and started down the long, deserted corridor of the mall. A little girl was playing alone in the middle of the mall. I stopped and watched her, for I was surprised to see her there alone.
Hello.
Say, it's getting pretty dark. Oughtn't you to go home?
Is it late?
Yes, it's late.
Well, I don't have to go home yet. Nobody's ready for me.
Well, it's rather strange for you to be here at this time.
I'll walk a ways with you if you don't mind. I guess it's a little lonely here by myself.
Why, that'll be fine. Come along. Are you all alone? Isn't anybody with you?
No. Who would there be? Anyway, you're with me. What have you got in the big envelope?
Oh, this? This is a portfolio. I carry my drawings in this.
Oh, I knew they were pictures.
How did you know?
Oh, I just knew. My name's Jenny, just so you'll know.
Jenny? Jenny what?
Jenny Appleton. We live in a hotel, but I don't see my mother and father very often. They're actors and actresses. They're at the Hammerstein Music Hall. They do juggling on a rope.
I see.
They're not home very much on account of being in the profession.
Wait a minute, Jenny. What was that you said about the Hammerstein Music Hall?
Why?
Oh, nothing. I was thinking for a moment that it had been torn down years ago.
Oh, no, how could it? Won't you take my hand?
Sure.
I go to school. I have very exciting lessons. I'm learning geography and history and about the Kaiser. You know, he's the king of Germany.
Well, he was, but that was long ago.
Oh, I think you're wrong. Cecily Jones is in my class, and I can fight her. I'm stronger than she is, and I can fight her good. It's fun to have somebody to play with.
Yes, I suppose it is.
Don't you have anyone to play with?
No.
Oh, that's too bad. Say, I know a song. Would you like to hear it?
Yes, I would.
Where I come from, nobody knows. And where I'm going, everything goes. The wind blows, the sea blows, and nobody knows.
Who taught you that?
Nobody taught me. Just a song.
Well, here's the exit, Jenny. Goodbye. I have to go now.
Do you know the game I like to play best?
No, Jenny.
It's a wishing game.
Well, what do you wish for most?
I wish you'd wait for me to grow up. But you won't, I guess.
I stood and watched her as she walked back down the mall. I waited until I couldn't see her anymore. And then I went back to my cold studio to face Mrs. Jeeks, the landlady. And I had no rent to give her. I guess I was getting pretty desperate the day I brought my sketches into the Matthews Gallery. There was a show on, and I guess I went in more out of curiosity than hope of selling anything. Mr. Matthews came out of his little office at the rear.
Yes, what can I do for you?
Why, I don't know. You could buy one of my pictures, perhaps.
Landscapes?
Yes, mostly.
I see. Well, I don't know. Of course, we buy very little, almost nothing, the times being what they are. However, let me see what you have. Landscapes. Too bad. I'm sorry, but... Oh, wait a minute. What's this?
Oh, that's not anything. That's only a sketch. It's just a little girl I met in the park. I was trying to remember something. I didn't know I'd brought it along with me.
Ah, but still, this is different. It's good. It's very good. Do you know why I like it? I can see the past in it. Yes, sir, I have seen that little girl before, somewhere. Yet I couldn't tell you where. Do me a portrait of the little girl in the park, and I'll make you famous.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get back to our guest, Joan Fontaine, right after this.
Get growing, you can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
With the ever-increasing cost of living, it's harder to save these days. Yet it's more important than ever to make that extra sacrifice to save. Why? Well, because tomorrow's dreams will still be financed with today's savings. Cromwell Savings Bank suggests that whatever the amount, you save on a regular weekly basis. It's a good habit that you'll be thankful you acquired. Visit Cromwell Savings and inquire about any one of their six convenient savings plans.
Grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, where you can now save Saturday mornings from 9 to 12 noon. Plenty of free parking available.
Joan Fontaine, it's been a pleasure having you here on the Golden Age of Radio. Thanks so much.
Dick and Ed, sounds like a vaudeville team.
It does.
I loved it. Thank you.
And a reminder that you'll be with Cactus Flower at the Chateau de Ville Dinner Theater in East Windsor until June 1st, so they'll have an opportunity to see you and really have a good evening's entertainment. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Bank, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell, a friendly bank in a friendly town. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bill Grasty and Dick Bertel.
Presents the Charlie McCarthy Show. This is Ken Carpenter, ladies and gentlemen, greeting you from Hollywood, California. On behalf of Edgar Bergen, Charlie McCarthy, Mortimer Stern.